Christina was a lot of fun to be with, and our physical relationship was wonderful. But I wasn't falling in love with her to the point of her being my girlfriend. A few months later, right before we went back to Europe to tour, I told her I couldn't see her anymore. She was pretty upset, but Guy O was beside himself. "I can't believe you're walking away from this girl. She's the first girl you've been with in a long time who's totally considerate. She brings you flowers. She loves you. She's beautiful. She's sexy. She's smart. But when you're not feeling it, you're not feeling it." When I broke up with her, she said, that really sucks. I was hoping that this relationship was going to go somewhere. But I understand. At least we had a lot of great sex. I was like, that's the spirit. Welcome, everybody. Wherever you are, it's that magical time of the day, this special time of the day, the magical hour. It's a time that we join you from the ethers of rock and roll. My name is Christian Overfield.
And I am Martha Guzman, and we are the hosts of the Rockstar Autobiography Podcast.
Join us as we review autobiographies by the greatest and most famous musicians in history. And that was Anthony Kaiitis from the band many people know as the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We read the book. The book is called Scar Tissue. I do feel that it's a great title. I really like it. I didn't know that it was the title of one of their songs, but it's a good title, I think. It's fitting for the book, ultimately. The book came out quite a while ago, I think about 14 years ago. And we're back. We read it again, like it was nothing, like it was just warm butter in a microwave. That's how skilled your hosts are at reading this book. We're, you know, here to talk about Anthony Kaiitis. Martha?
Yes.
You read it too.
I did.
I know.
I
know.
Did.
The one, you know, if we were arrested and, you know, put in separate rooms and the police tried to play us off one another and they said, "Hey, you know, your partner over there, she ratted you out. She never read the book." I'd say, "I know you're lying because Martha always reads the book." That's, you know, like she's a fixture of the universe. One thing I know about Martha, we might have disagreements, but she reads the book, man. And I read it too. We're
reluctantly sometimes, but I read the book.
We're dependable. We show up. We're good students. We get good grades. We read the book.
Yes. And you know, the other day I was actually thinking about my level of dependability, Christian.
Okay.
I seriously was thinking about this. And I was thinking that that's probably one of my least favorite traits about myself, that I'm just so dependable.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was thinking about that because people just know, like, if Martha's involved, we can depend on her. And I thought, you know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that. I really do. I was thinking about that as I was stuck on the 101 going.
Well, I can, you know what, actually, it's funny you should say that because I can relate to that because I do feel like to a certain extent people take advantage of me because they know all. He's dependable. He'll show up and he'll do the thing. I can continue to be myself, which is not dependable. And sometimes that rubs me the wrong way. But my video game character's programmed to be that way. And even though I resent it, I still resent it in an organized, dependable way.
But I do like that being mentioned in the context of books. I am a dependable person when it comes to, you can always find my nose in a book. Yes, we can.
And if you were to look the past 2 weeks, you would have found our noses in the belly button lint of Anthony Kaiitis.
Oh, I don't know quite if it would have been quite that serious, but I understand what you're saying.
You know, I debated about whether or not we should, why not? This is silly. I feel like our feelings about this particular band are so strong that it wasn't a good idea to like front load with that. But I realize it's just stupid. I mean, you know what? It is our show, you know, and we read the book. That's still, you know, what's funny, Martha?
Yeah.
Is I don't know why I should care about expressing my opinion when 99, I would say 90, fine. 90% of all Red Hot Chili Pepper fans probably have not read the book. You and I have done something again. That I bet 90% of Red Hot Chili Pepper fans have not done. And still, for whatever reason, I'm like, I don't know if we should be upfront about our opinions because it's a strong
one. Maybe they have.
But, you know, Martha, please, how do you feel about the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
I don't like them.
You don't?
I don't like them.
Do you have an experience with them?
You know, I know the music, and the videos and all of that, but they were never, they've never been a band that necessarily appeal to my musical taste or to, you know, how all of these bands, Christian, how they all they always talk about how there's a look, right, that they have to join the band.
Yes.
Well, there is a certain kind of look that a band has to have in order for me to kind of gravitate or be intrigued or interested.
Wait, are you saying a sock on a cock is not it for you?
No, no, it's really not. And so they've just never exactly been a band that has appealed to me.
Right.
Aesthetically, visually, musically. So I can't say that I am a fan.
Okay.
But of course, you know, how can you not know who the Red Hot Chili Peppers are, especially here in LA? They're an LA band. You know, we all know who they are. We all know the music. But no, they're not one of my favorites.
Okay. No experience with them, really. Apart from okay, it's fine.
Yeah, no experience really, apart from, you know, just listening to, you know, when things came on the radio, especially in the early 90s and whatnot. But no, not a whole lot. No.
Okay. Well, I never liked the Red Hot Chili Peppers when they were first doing their thing at the beginning. Even though I didn't like it then, I at least thought, well, they're doing their own thing and it seems to be unfiltered and it may not be pleasing to my ears. And their whole just rebellious, we're just kind of punks who just seem to thumb our nose at everything. We, you know, do the Abbey Road crossing with socks or penises. And we just sort of define themselves. Without authority, these people never would have a career because there's nothing to challenge or to throw rocks at. Their identity seemed to be that. Even when I was, you know, young and 16 or 8, whatever the age was, I could look at this band and go, oh, you're just aggressive misfits who are always spitting in the face of your teacher, you know. And the music I didn't understand or get at all. But when they first began, I thought, okay, but they're at least kind of doing their own thing. I just don't happen to like it. But then they morphed into, to me, I seriously think they're now in competition to be the world's worst band. That you can find. They're horrifically awful now whereas they had some kind of bizarro integrity before, I feel like they basically, whoever it is that Dave Grohl went to get his makeover, to be neutered as this bland Foo Fighter thing, they went to the same person and said, hey, how do we become like a midlife adult rockers? And now it's like if Vans, the shoe company, if the corporation were to produce music, it would sound like who the Red Hot Chili Peppers are today. It's completely absent any musical talent, any musical ability. And the only thing they ever had going for them, I thought, was their kind of weird punk rock spirit. You know, at least that was true. Now it's gone. And they've got those sort of weird hyper hairsprayed gelled haircuts. And the music is horrific because, look, nobody ever thought that you were melodicists or songwriters. And now that's all you're trying to do. So to me, it's aggressively awful. Anyway.
But no. How do you really feel? I don't think you've articulated it enough, Christian. I don't think our listeners will really be able to get the gist of your feelings.
It really is because it's just that. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not gonna.
Yeah, I don't really follow them. I know that they have. I believe that they have a new album out.
Yeah, ironically, I think it came out like a day ago.
I think. I think that I know I saw something not that long ago talking about mm-hmm. them having a new album. Mm-hmm. It does seem as though Flea, however, might, you know, I have to be really honest with you. There's something about Flea that I feel maybe...
Seems more genuine to you?
Yes, and there might be a little bit... I'd be interested to read his book, I think. And, yeah. and we will eventually get to it. I think that there might be a little bit more... there'd be more that he might be more musically... I don't know. I feel that there's, like, musically trained. There might be a more interesting story. Yeah, I think there might be a more interesting story there, perhaps. Yeah. But we will get to Flea's book when we get to that book, because right now we're talking about Anthony or Tony or Swan.
So when I lived in Santa Monica, Palisades, one day when I went to Santa Monica College, I was just waiting at the light to turn left on Pico, where there's Tommy's Burgers. Mm-hmm. And this car pulled up. It was a cat, like a convertible. And out of it, literally hop Anthony Kiedis and Flea. And they ran to the Tommies. And they were shirtless, of course. I don't think they're capable of going anywhere with shirts on. And they were grabbing their Tommies, you know. And it felt like, oh, yeah, this is exactly how I think of them. And this is exactly what they're doing. And I got to say, though, I was looking at them going, how do you maintain that physique while eating Tommies, you know? But whatever.
I was going to say, because, okay, I'm glad you pointed that out, because, I mean, those guys are fit.
They were.
I mean, have to be, I guess, if you're going to be shirtless all the time.
All the time. That's... And I got to say, after everything we've read, I was like, how do you maintain that body with that, with the life you've led? I think some people are just genetically blessed, and he is one of them. But there is I had a bizarre intersection of sorts with Anthony Kiedis' life. And it's interesting, certainly in light of what we read about in his book, because his book seemed to be really just a memoir of drug use. And
yes.
And his Rolodex.
Womanizing.
Of womanizing. Well, which is, yes. Sure, I think actually you could apply the term womanize. I wouldn't disagree. My mother, this is funny, I think, story. My mother has a very large home. There's no other way to put it. And good for her. You know what I mean? It's a long story. It's a giganto house. So much so that she and her husband rent out a wing, W-I-N-G, a wing of the house.
Oh, my goodness. Christian.
Right. So for a brief period of time, they rented out the wing of that house to one of Anthony Kiedis' girlfriends.
Stop it.
Yes. So,
which one? Oh my goodness, Christian! Is your mom listening to this episode? Is your mom going to be listening?
Yes, she is. I'm sure she's going to be furious that I mentioned any of this. But whatever.
Oh no! That's just,
right. So that's the way in which I'm rock and roll, man. And I thumb my nose at authority. I just spill the beans on the family here.
Oh my goodness!
So I only knew that because my mother, you know, told me that ahead of time. She's like, you know, our new tenant is dating Anthony Kiedis. So I went online, and at that time, Martha, there was an actual website dedicated, and clearly by his female fans, Anthony Kiedis' female fans had created a website, the sole purpose of which was to keep the fans updated about whom he was currently dating.
Oh, my goodness. And it's very common, though, for fans to do that,
by the way. So it showed...
Your mom's house?
No. It showed every single one of his previous girlfriends in the chronological order in which he dated them. And then sure enough, in the current, like, live, real-time feed moment... Was the picture of the girl. And then Christmas Eve that year, she wound up spending with my mom and our family. And I got
the girlfriend. Why didn't he take her to Michigan and then to St. Bart's like all the others?
Yeah, she wasn't lucky enough to join him on one of his drug benders. I guess she probably couldn't find the seedy motel he was staying at. So she's like, I'll stay with the Overfields this year. And so, you know, she was super nice, super sweet, very attractive. She had the Ione Sky kind of vibe going a little bit.
Oh, really?
And she went on to, after, of course, this might come as a shock to you, Martha, but their relationship didn't last.
Oh, no. Christian, right? You're lying. I know this isn't true. Based on this book, you're lying to me.
Who can say? I might be telling the truth or not. She then went on to date a member of Weezer.
She was into the rock stars.
She was, yes. And I gotta say, having met her, she reminded me of those girls who get together with other attractive females and drive out to the woods and take pictures of themselves with, like, you know, wreaths in their hair made of dandelions.
You know what I mean?
Like the anthropology type. Just like that look on their face, like, how did we get out here in the woods taking these pictures cool, like, Polaroid filters and stuff? But to her credit,
I love that you said anthropology, girl. I know totally what you're talking about.
I will say she was really bright. We talked, actually, just the two of us for quite a long time. We had just recently read.
Oh, my gosh. Were you hitting on Anthony's girlfriend, Christian?
I was doing my best to send out some flirtatious vibe. I'm sure it was very mild compared to what she was used to. She and I had just read Under the Banner of Heaven together. So we talked about it for quite some time.
Oh, wow.
But I will say, seriously, to her credit, she was really smart. And she went on to have a super successful, she started a business as a jeweler or I don't know, something. But she's very successful now. And she was very bright.
But I need to know this. Is she mentioned in the book?
She's not. And for obviously, like you, I was like really hoping to see her name, but she's not.
Yes, yes.
And then, but the funniest part, not the funniest part, but the, you know, most true to life part is, like, 6 months later when I went back to the same website and her picture had been moved down one position.
Oh my goodness. The picture it was now down like 30 pictures, yeah, right? It was like 30 pictures.
She's like
down.
An alumnus member, you know? Yeah.
Wow. Well, I love that. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah. So we should get started.
Yes.
I mean, the book is long, everybody. It's
465 pages long.
It's long. I just want to get started by saying that somebody along the way, apparently, I discovered this subsequent to reading the book. I went on to Wikipedia, and for a while, for the past 10 years, there has been talks or have been talks about turning his life with his father into a television show. Did you know that, Martha?
Oh my gosh, I did not know that.
Well, I'm not surprised because as I was reading
lends itself to that.
As I was reading that, I've really come to believe that, first of all, you and I are now official rock and roll historians. And I think for sure, somebody out there who's got power, who's listening to our show, the same way The Crown has taken history and made history like this amazing spectacle.
Best show ever.
Certainly, I think one of the greatest shows of all time. So if I were in charge, Martha, and I should be, the first season of our show, if we could curate it. It would be the Manchester season. It would be one season devoted to all the people in England, New Order, Joy Division, The Smiths, the Hacienda, Manchester. That is absolutely its own season. But without question, oh my God, season two would be Los Angeles in the early 80s. And all these people who came together at Fairfax High School, who, you know, had touched into the valley. I mean, you've got now Lenny Kravitz. You've got Anthony Kiedis. There are so many people. It's just such a ripe period of time. And I got to say, you know, I'm starting to have mixed feelings about what I'm reading. Let's just talk about what we're reading, which is Anthony. I feel like we got to condense it in some way.
Oh, we do. Yeah. We do. And I think that maybe we should just start.
Sure. Why don't you do that?
Briefly giving a little bit of his background. So he was actually born in Michigan. He was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. His parents split pretty early on when he was a young child, with his mom staying in Michigan in Grand Rapids with his mom and his dad actually moving out here. Or no, they were there first and then they moved out here as a family unit. They moved out to California after his dad received a scholarship to UCLA to go to film school. Soon after that, they moved back to Grand Rapids after a summer family visit, but he actually ended up staying there with his mom, who shortly after remarried, and she married his dad's best friend. She got together with him, and then they ended up getting married. And so he would see his dad occasionally, as is the case when parents divorce. So he would spend summers out here in LA with his dad, and then he'd go back to Michigan after his summer vacation. But his dad was, in my opinion, Christian, I think that Anthony got the taste of that rock star lifestyle from a very early age through his dad, who was, you know, pretty carefree. He'd originally gone to film school at UCLA, but he soon, you know, kind of stopped doing that because he started dealing drugs and he became a smuggler and all this craziness. But he was very much entrenched in the LA music scene when that was kind of just surfacing in terms of, you know, the Sunset Strip and doing all of that. And so, you know, Anthony would come out here in the summers to spend time with him, and he was exposed to all of that because, as he tells us very early on in the book, his dad was more of a friend. It was more of like he was almost his sidekick, his, you know, 11-year-old sidekick.
Kathy going Valentine all over again.
Oh, totally, totally. Just kind of hanging out with his dad. And he loved being with his dad, obviously, right? I mean, at home, he had rules, and his home life with his mom wasn't the best because the husband wasn't exactly the nicest character around. So he really enjoyed spending time out here in LA. And then eventually, you know, he starts having a lot of issues. You know, he's rebellious. He's just defiant. He doesn't really think the rules apply to him. And he says that from a very, very early age, you know, he just felt that he didn't have to do anything. And he really, you get the sense, at least I did, Christian, that he really looked up to his dad and that he really admired his dad. And he, you know, he talks about how his dad was dressing a certain way. Well, then he wanted to dress that way too and be like his dad. You know, I think he thought his dad was just the epitome of coolness. And who wouldn't have thought that? Mm-hmm. His dad was super carefree, mm-hmm. having all sorts of people and girlfriends over all the time and partying. And, you know, home was different. So he really gravitated to that. And once he becomes a little bit older, he starts really rebelling. And his mom starts having a difficult time with reining him in. So what ends up happening is that he convinces her, and she finally agrees to let him move out here to LA at the age of 11, which
disaster,
which I felt was the beginning of the end for Anthony. Once you get into the book and you learn more about him, you realize, you know, how disastrous that truly was. And not that he already didn't have that sort of spirit in him. You know, he was very rebellious and again, like I said, defiant. But that combination of what his personality was already like and then bringing that to LA where there were no rules and his dad was just partying, doing drugs, bringing all these girlfriends over while he was there and taking him out, too. To party.
Well,
we
got to go into the specifics.
Yes.
I mean, this is straight up how social services today would have been called in an instant. I mean,
absolutely.
His childhood was destroyed and poisoned with not just adulthood, but the most poisonous kind of adulthood.
Absolutely.
I lost track, but he goes to his dad's house. He's raised on Playboy and Penthouse magazines.
Yes.
All over the place. Dad's part
scattered.
And his dad's one of those parents like Kathy Valentine's that seem to take pride in how quickly can I expose my son to every adult extreme.
Smokes his first joint with his dad at the age of 11.
Yeah. And his dad makes a ceremony of it. Like, come out to the table, son. Here's your first joint. And let's sit at the table with my current 18-year-old girlfriend.
Correct.
And we'll talk her into bringing out her boob. And you can take a picture of it together because that's something that a 12-year-old. Is he 12 even or 10?
No, at that point he was 11. No, he was 11 at that point.
He was older. He was just, that's okay. I mean, it's like, I couldn't believe the thing. I mean, I can. I'm just not surprised by anything I'm reading anymore.
Correct.
But I mean, his life in terms of the poison done, it felt like adults got bored and said, how quickly can we shoot adulthood into this guy's veins. And it was, this father seemed to take pride in it, which was incredible.
He did.
And then it's not okay. It's not enough that he's having his son do drugs with him, but he then enlists his son in the process of selling the drugs together.
Correct.
And they sell they go on the, it felt like I was reading Goodfellas when he's meeting in hotels.
Yes, yes.
They're going to motels. He's bringing his son with him. And he's even specifying the way in which his son should behave when and if the police come to arrest him or them. He's got a whole plan and a script. I think, doesn't he make Anthony memorize a script to tell the police?
He tells him, yes. He tells him, okay, son, if this happens, this is what you say. And then you have to run in that direction. And don't worry, we'll meet up again. Yeah. But you have to say these things, and you have to run, and you have to hide, and you have to do, et cetera. I mean, he has a whole itinerary of things that he has to take care of and how he has to do it in order for them to make sure to escape the cops if he were to get caught.
You know, it's funny. Only now, in this exact second that I'm talking to you, do I realize at no point in this autobiography does he ever condemn his father. Does he ever does he ever say, in hindsight, gee, I can see that. He doesn't do that. And that is super weird to me now that I think about it. Although if you consider the way in which the book ends, which is really no different than it begins, I guess it makes sense.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a portion of the book, and this going back to how I think this would make a great television series. Somehow or other, Martha, these people seem to rub circles with. I mean, I get the impression he's living in squalor with his drug dealing dad.
It sounds that way.
And yet somehow it is school. He's bumping into social circles such that no less than Sonny Bono becomes his godfather. Is it right?
And well, both Sonny Bono and the 18-year-old girl. Well, no, the 18-year-old girlfriend who then. So the 18-year-old girlfriend, his dad's 18-year-old girlfriend, who he first shares that joint with and whose boob he takes a picture of.
Right.
She then breaks up with the dad, or they break up, and she ends up dating Sonny Bono divorces Cher.
Got it.
And they all stay friendly, and so the dad knows a ton of well-to-do, you know, people because that's who he's dealing with. Yeah. That's who he's dealing with too. You know,
we got to start doing drugs, Martha.
No, we don't.
Forget the podcast. There's a shortcut here. You gotta not take advantage of.
No, we do not.
All right. Well, if you're listening out there, you DM me, as they say, because I want a shortcut. I'll just do the drugs. I'm tired of reading these books.
No.
Fine.
So
go ahead.
So so the girlfriend, they all stay friendly, and this 18-year-old girlfriend moves on to, you know, bigger and better.
Greener pastures.
And so they're trying to get him into a good junior high because obviously he's moved here. And so they end up, because they're all friendly, they end up using Sonny Bono's address.
Oh, that's
and
right.
And his home as his residence.
Martha, so how many people in the world get to say that?
I know. I was a little bit in disbelief reading
so
all this because I thought to myself, wow, so you're living in this makeshift. He has like a makeshift bedroom because the house that he lives in with his dad, it does sound like it was falling apart. and so he ends up, he said that essentially her name was Connie, this woman. And so he ends up essentially becoming their surrogate child. And they take him on trips skiing and exposing him to everything. He talks about how he would go there after school sometimes and just hang out with them. And basically he had reign over that house where he was able to just, you know, ask for whatever he wanted. And obviously the housekeeper, the people that work there would tend to his every need if he wanted that. Yeah. So, you know, there is a sense of even though he wasn't exactly rich because of his parents or wealthy or anything like that, you know, he did have this exposure and the sense of entitlement, which he later talks about in his book, provided to him at a young age. Because on the one hand, you have a father who's completely irresponsible, who is not necessarily, you know, being a dad, letting him do whatever he wants. Then he has this home that he goes to, this mansion where he has housekeepers and people that can tend to his every need, going on fancy trips. So
with Sonny Bono.
With Sonny Bono,
it's bonkers to think about.
I know. And so he ends up, you know, living in some ways a life of privilege, right?
Yeah.
Because he's able to do whatever he wants with absolutely no no rules. There's nothing that he can do that it will be looked upon or frowned upon, except, he tells us, one time when Sonny Bono tells him, the one thing I will not tolerate is you lying.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. And he makes this really big issue of that with him. And he says, you know, you can't lie to me. And he says he explains to him why that's so important. But other than that, I mean, he really was living... He was living the life of a rock star before he even became a rock star, essentially.
I have to say, the story he tells about Cher, you're not a man slash person who's ever been a boy. That story was unreal to read. It is truly a fantasy come to life. He tells a story that one night, for whatever reason, it's Sonny's out or whatever. It's Cher's turn to take care of young 12-year-old or 13. Who cares? Anthony Kiedis.
He was 13, I believe, at that time.
They spend the evening together in bed watching movies or whatnot. And then
hanging out.
Yeah. And then when it's time to go to bed, she goes and undresses in the full total nude and he pretends to be asleep. And I felt 100% sure she knew he was awake. This, I mean, I felt like she was doing this on purpose just to titillate the boy and give him a moment that he would never forget. And he doesn't, because it's in the book. And I just fathom what it is to see be 13, to see Cher getting completely naked, then putting on a nightie and coming to bed in the same bed with him.
Yeah.
I tell you, Martha, how things have changed in the past 15 years. I mean, this book today, I don't think you could get this book published today.
Well, and I think, you know, I don't think any woman, unless it's your own child, you know, would be getting in bed with, I mean, nothing happened. I mean, it was nothing like that, but he's recounting this story as a young boy,
seeing all of this,
but yeah, I mean, some of the stories, like those, you know, where he is like his dad, he talks about how his dad essentially had reign over the best table at the Rainbow Room on Sunset.
Yeah.
And, you know, rock stars, Led Zeppelin and all these different people are coming up to them and hanging out. Yes. Yeah. And they're like, wait, shouldn't you be in bed? Like it's like midnight or whatever. Yeah. Like, why are you here?
Yeah.
I mean, it's wild. And he sees his dad, you know, when drug deals don't go well, he sees his dad getting beaten up outside of these clubs, but then it's all good because they go back to the house and party and there's more drugs and sex and rock and roll and he's there,
you know? You know what's weird about it all?
Yes.
Everything you just said is all accurate. There's a bizarre kind of Batman and Robin togetherness about the story. The way in which the dad brought him into these adventures, it's like we're a team, a father and son team that attack Los Angeles, and his dad would grind up drugs for the both of them and put them in bananas to mask the taste and give Anthony his portion, which is smaller because he wasn't as... That's the extent of the father's parenting. I'll give you a smaller portion of the drugs because I know your body can't take it like mine. But then we'll go out to the Rainbow Room together and we'll hold court over Los Angeles.
I kept thinking to myself, how is that excusable? How is that even... like, I don't understand that, right? Yeah. But it happens. I mean, the whole relationship between them.
Well, the strangest, I kind of gave up after a while bringing any kind of normal rules to the story I was reading. When the father facilitates the first time that his father, that Anthony has sexual intercourse.
Oh, my gosh.
What is he, 12? I think he's 12 years old.
And, he's 12 years old.
Anthony's like, hey, I kind of like a girlfriend. I think your girlfriend said it'd be okay if I had, you know, intercourse with her. And the dad's like, cool, yeah, let's make that happen. And they do. Some father sons go fishing. You
know. I mean, had he even had the birds and the bees talk with his kid, you know, he was already experienced. I mean, he was seeing all of it, so he didn't have to have a talk with him anymore. He'd already seen everything, right?
Yeah, there's no talk.
It's just, that was interesting.
Their weird moral code is when Anthony asks for the event to happen a second time. The dad,
with another one of his young the
girlfriends. The dad's like, oh, no, son, just that one time. this one's off limits. Go get your own.
I know, that's what I thought too. I thought, oh, so it was just the one. It was the one that deflowered him because totally. That was going to be a special one. But everything else is off limits.
Yeah, what actually became even more, not more, but just more riveting to me is when this insane father decides he has complete. I'm no longer a drug dealer. That's not my identity. My new identity is I'm an actor.
Oh, right. He starts taking acting
and
classes.
What are the odds, Martha, that you and I would read two books back to back wherein a major character is named Spider?
I thought of that too, Christian. I thought, oh no, we're coming across another Spider.
Yeah, I've surrendered. I want to be called Spider. I want that. That's
no
my
more
name.
Christian.
Just Spider.
It's Spider.
Yeah. And then I'll know I've made it.
So, I know. When I read that, I thought of you right away. Yeah. I thought, oh no, here we go again with this nickname.
So the dad, it was just really weird. He doesn't just decide. He goes hardcore. He joins.
Oh, big time.
He joins like the equivalent of the action studio Stella Adler Theater of Acting. Even legally.
And changes his name.
Changes. And you know what? If you legally do anything, that's a lot of work. I mean, you got to go down to some office and get some paper and get things notarized.
Listen, I know. It's the reason I always knew I would never change my last name when I got married.
It's so much work, you know? He changed his name with a straight face to Blackie, and I'm assuming it's Demet.
Because I wasn't sure of that either. I was like, is it Demet? That's how I read
it
to Christian.
I think it might be. If you broke apart the correct rules of language and grammar, it looks like it should be Dammit, but
that's what I thought too, Christian, which made it the more hysterical to me because I was like, wait a minute. I think that the dad was going for like some sort of humor in this or something because I thought the same thing. So yeah, he changes his name to Blackie Dammit.
It's got to be Demet.
Demet, right?
It's got to be because Dammit is just so stupid.
It's too much. But I thought it was, I thought the same, Christian. I thought it probably was intended to be like a play on words, you know, sort of thing.
I almost thought it was worse that he asked his son to join him in this part two journey of his life. It's like,
haven't you damaged him enough?
Part at least produces money. It's more appropriate to the time, but with a straight face, you're a grown man. You've got multiple children, I think. I don't even know.
No, he didn't. It was just him.
You're going to go to acting class and you've changed your name and this is your new identity. And, you know, Anthony, again, the dude clearly adores his dad. You really get the sense he adores
worships
his dad.
Him.
Oh, yeah.
He worships him.
And there is a pattern to that. I hope that you have seen to these books is that sons, that's how they feel about their fathers. And that's what he feels about his dad, who's now.
Well, it's one extreme or the other, though, Christian. In these books, it's either the son and the father just absolutely adore one another, or they have a very distant relationship. And the same with the mothers. It seems like it's one or the other. But you know what? I do understand in part, Christian, why he would make this huge transformation and why all of this happened too. I think that with these, when you read about all these addictions, right? It seems like there is an obsessive and intense factor associated with addiction. It appears that way anyway, right? And
I imagine it's just another extreme.
It's just another extreme. It's like, you know what? I was doing this. Now I want a whole new life. And now I'm going to do it. And I am going to totally immerse myself in it. And you know what? I'm even changing my name so I can really be this new person.
So you'll super take me seriously.
Totally. Yeah. So it does make sense why he would be so extreme. But when he does take Anthony along on this ride, you know, he ends up acting too. And and that's where the chasm between them begins. Because it ends up happening that whereas his dad has like even changed his name and his look and all of this, and he's not exactly making it, whereas
Anthony is,
and which soon makes, enough
that makes that just makes sense. Is I feel like child actors, if you will, there's just a different kind of opportunity for them.
Of course. And it made sense to me too. I was like, of course he would have. Yeah. Of course he would have been the one, you know, and he talks about how he starts raking in a ton of cash and he's he's definitely making money and he's making more than his dad. And so it becomes a thing with his dad where it's kind of like, wait a minute, you're a kid and you're making more money. And it's sort of this man, I imagine it's a man pride thing, right? Sure, I mean, that's the way that I understood that. Yeah. But sure enough, you know, and Anthony then tells us that the roles that he's getting are no different than what he is like in real life. You know, he's getting after school specials and things like that to be in those programs, but
he gets to work with Sylvester Stallone.
He gets to, oh, that was such a funny story.
Yeah. I think the movie was Fist, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I love that. I've heard stories about Sylvester Stallone that go both ways. And this is not a positive story of Sylvester Stallone.
No.
Because I guess Anthony decides to take his role seriously and knock on the trailer door of Sylvester. He's like, hey, let's rehearse. And Sylvester's having none of it. And he's like, get this kid out of here. So I love that.
That, I felt bad for him. I felt a little bad. Like, you know, he was so eager to let's get together and let's go over our scenes together. Yeah. And
What's my motivation?
Yeah. And he tells him, he's so cute because he tells him, you know, I feel like we should bond before we have our scene together.
I don't think so.
And Sylvester Stallone's like, how'd you get in here? Yeah. How'd you get to my trailer?
Yeah, I love it. This is not supposed to happen, kid.
he totally burst his bubble.
I couldn't get the impression it was that burst. He seemed to not, you know, amount of crazy in this kid's life, I don't feel like he ever got a sense to breathe, to have his feelings hurt.
And well, no, he did
like
cocaine.
One day out of many, you know?
Well, yeah, and the first time he tries cocaine, I think he's something like 13, and the first time he tries heroin, he's 14.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you read about this and you're just like, wow, that is intense.
Yeah. So apparently he's going to uni high, which was interesting for me because my father went to uni high for.
Really?
Yeah, he did. Uni high was in a different area of LA than Fairfax. And then he goes to Fairfax High, which, oh my God, quantity of people that have come from that school.
Yeah.
That's where he meets Flea and basically his band and so forth. And that's where things start happening for him. And, you know, he starts going on adventures. And I got to ask you, Martha, at this point of the book.
Yes.
You know, I've mentioned before a certain kind of skater alpha A type personality.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
You know, I'm going with this, right? And
yes,
he is just clearly one of those people.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg. I don't know if it's environments like his that produce people like him.
Yes.
But a part of me is, as I read it, I feel, and again, this is just me interrupting the entire narrative. I feel, I go out of my way to shelter my son. I make, in a way, more so than I ever was. Okay. I want him protected from the world.
That's the path
I'm choosing for my son. But by the same token, when I read about the quantity of amazing experiences that people like Anthony Kiedis have, part of me is jealous. I really am. I mean, I don't want to break my back. I don't want to just break my hand. And I don't want to be a heroin addict. I don't want those things. But it would be dishonest to say that life doesn't come with the kind of experience, you know, that is interesting, you know? And
yes.
And part of me once in a while is jealous and thinks, I mean, I'm feeling that way by the time he's only 12 years old. You know what I mean? We haven't even got to when he's 14 years old. He's just, you know.
Like, oh, my goodness.
There's a scene where
he
meets Flea. Okay. And they get along fairly well. And they go on this adventure while they're in high school. They go to Mammoth, and I think they're like hitchhiking. They don't have any money. They don't know where they're going, where they're going to stay, what they're going to do. The only plan of action they have is wherever we get, whenever we arrive, let's sleep in the laundry room because it'll be heated. I mean, who leads their life with that kind of, you know what I mean? With that kind of measuring stick, right?
And
they go and they have this crazy adventure and they arrive and they almost freeze to death, but they manage to find the hotel, luckily. And then they go skiing, and they try to use a stolen credit card, but that's its own story. And then Anthony has to pretend to be Flea's mom because the person at the desk won't permit the card without the right identity. And then they steal skis. And I mean, that's just one tiny weekend out of the guy's entire life. And that one weekend, Martha,
yes,
that's filled with so much more rule breaking than my entire life combined.
I think I understand. I think it's probably different, for men or for boys,
yeah,
you know, than I think it would be. I mean, when I read about this, I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, that's so crazy. But I don't know that I would have wanted personally to partake in anything like that as a young girl. Boys, especially at that age, are just looking for adventure. I think it's
some boys.
Some boys. But I think that it's also just biological in terms of, you know, I think generally speaking, you know, boys do like, they seek adventure in a much more daredevilish sort of way. I think some kids do anyway than girls do. So I think that that's also part of it. But certainly by the time that he is 14 years old, he had experienced more life,
yes,
than I had at about 20.
20? He's lived more life than you'll ever live.
No. Oh, of course. But I'm saying in terms of the adultness of, you know, the life that he is exposed to so much of adulthood at such an early age that I didn't even know about till I was older person.
I got to qualify what we're saying because it's something I do think about a lot when I'm reading this book. It's not adulthood per se. It is a kind of going off the path of organized living. It is anarchy. It's anarchy. That's what it is. It's anarchy. It is chaos. And, you know, going into the next part of what he does, that's what it is. And I think it's also part and parcel of what attracts, which how can we not get to? Because it's 50% of the whole book are the quantity of women that seem to find him to be the most irresistible sexual object in the world. And I think a lot of it must be this kind of attitude that he has, this kind of chaotic, forbidden quality, because to morph into what I was about to say, he then decides with his friend, it's not enough to go skateboarding into pools. He needs to go to multiple story buildings with friends, jump off of multiple stories and land into these swimming pools. That blew my mind, Martha. And
and
part two, you and I have read so many of these stories where people like this, Martha, they seem to always have luck on their side. This guy is jumping off of like third and fourth story buildings into swimming pools and just thinks it's fun. Even his dad is like, I think that's a bad idea. And you know, you've gone out of control when you're drug dealing, name changing, acting dad who encouraged you to sleep with this girlfriend is saying, I think you've gone a little far here when you're jumping into swimming pools that are hundreds of feet beneath you. And of course, the inevitable happens. What does he do, Martha?
Breaks his back.
He literally breaks his back.
He breaks his back.
And I tell you, the way in which he does it, he lands on his feet. He misjudges because, of course, it's got to happen one day. And he lands on his feet, and apparently what that does is it flattens.
Oh.
I know, right?
I know. When I read that, I felt that pain.
I did too. There were two moments of this book, one where I felt the pain and one that was so disgusting. And I was like, we got to that part, Martha, when we get there,
yes,
I remember thinking, I don't know if Martha's going to continue with the show after reading that sentence. It's so disgusting, but we'll get there. He flattens every vertebrae in his back.
Every single one.
He lands on his feet from like the third or fourth story building and he misjudges and he breaks. That is, it's a real thing, people. You can break your back. He does it. And he recuperates. And you know what? It's not enough that he breaks his back. He's supposed to stay basically in traction, lying supine for 4 weeks at least.
Right, right.
How long does he last, Martha?
Oh my gosh, I think it's like a week or a couple of days.
Yeah. He's like, I need out.
He's like, I'm done.
Yeah.
This is over.
But
I can't do
this
anymore.
Not before putting his, before hitting on every nurse in the building.
As a teenager. He's not even like 16 years old at this point. I mean, he's a kid. He's like a freshman or a sophomore in high school.
But really his psychology has been it's been put on crack. So now he's got the mindset now, the exposure to, like, for lack of a better word, the adult. Hood, if you will, but he's still a kid. It's chaos inside of him. And the first thing he does when he breaks out of the hospital, doesn't break out, but he leaves early on his own will.
Right, right.
He forces his friend to drive him back to the building so he can kind of figure out how he misjudged.
I was incredulous of that. I thought,
in fact,
why?
The only thing I'm surprised he didn't do was jump all over again. You know, like, right. I'm going to do it again and see, I can show the world that you know.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because a part of you, I know for me, a part of me was almost thinking, he's not going to try and do it again, is he? Mm. I mean, because at this point, you've already read so much crazy that you wouldn't put it past him if he tried doing it again, even with a broken back.
Yeah.
Because his life is just, he lives it. Even from that young age at 1,000 miles per hour. And he just does not care. He just does not care about anything.
You know,
and he talks about that. He talks about how he is just after the thrill.
Yeah.
And he's after the moment.
I love that you said he lives at 1,000 miles an hour. That is very accurate. And I will say, at this moment of the book, I was greatly enjoying it. I really enjoyed. I just love reading about the LA experience and these people and these kids. And you forget that you're reading about a famous person. You just can't believe the life that you're reading about. And I really,
but you know what, Christian, I had a different take on it the whole time I was reading about all of that. I think because it was just so crazy and wild. The aunt in me, as I was reading this, was mortified. I kept thinking, like, everything about it was stressing me out as I was reading. I was just, I had to keep reminding myself that this was a child.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was, I don't know, it was a lot.
I will add to that or say that the story about him jumping into pools had me more, for lack of a better word, more riveted to the page and afraid than any of the drug stories that came next. I mean, the drug stories are like, they're just so unimaginative and boring at this point.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I became numb to them.
Even though obviously—
Just the way he became numb to, the drugs, I became numb to him recounting story after story.
Right, that's why I said at this point in the book, I was really enjoying it, because it is the story remains unique to him. The drug story has become boring now. Well, I've read 100 of these, and whatever you write can't make them a whole lot more interesting. But this part, I can fairly say, I've never read anything like this so far. It is your story. And I will say that something that never leaves the entirety of the story, even though it starts to get to me repetitive and uninteresting, is I really feel like, to a certain extent, this person gets a pass for who he turns out to be. It's like, if that's what you expose your kid to, if that's the water, if that's those are the ingredients that you put into the water that you then nourish the plant with, that's who you're going to produce. And I really felt like, even though I didn't like a lot of what we then came to read, I didn't hold him that responsible for a lot of it. You know,
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, I mean, how can you when you read, you know, the upbringing that he had? You know, I mean, it's inevitable that something that type of environment is going to create what eventually ends up happening to him, you know? And I think it's important for us to also note, Christian, that like others whom we've read about, he ends up moving out of his house, out of his dad's house, at a fairly young age. I think he's either 15 or 16 at the time.
Yeah.
And he ends up moving out because his dad, once he takes on this new role, literally, as an actor, and he is, you know, trying to change and do things differently, he also starts trying to enforce rules.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was ridiculous.
I thought so too. I thought, of course your kid's not going to want to do what you're telling him to after you've been exposing him to everything and you've been his best friend and now you're trying to be a dad. Honey, it doesn't work that way.
Curfew? Are you serious?
Oh my God. And his curfew. And I was in hysterics. So he's like 14 or something or 15 and his curfew was midnight.
Yeah.
This kid was 14. Well, what time was he coming home before that? You know? He ends up telling his dad, like, I'm out of here. What are you talking about rules? And I don't blame him. I would have reacted the same way.
Yeah.
So he ends up leaving and moving in with a kid who's dropped out, who's 16 years old. And that's where the crazy really takes on a whole different. He really ends up going off the deep end at that point.
What was interesting about the book to me, I thought, I'm having a hard time here, is everything that Martha just said happens just like that. And then almost immediately on the next page, we read that he gets accepted into UCLA.
Yes.
And I was like, that shook my faith. I don't have any faith in the educational system anymore at all. But this, to me, really hammered home. I'm not understanding here. There's absolutely no way somebody with the life that we're reading about that Anthony Kiedis had, where he's doing drugs and having intercourse at the age of four, and there's no way this kid is getting grades to get into UCLA.
But he is.
He tells us. Impossible.
He tells us but that he must as crazy as he was and as, you know, unstable as his home and family life was, he was extremely dedicated to getting good grades.
Do you know how hard it is to get in UCLA now, Martha?
Well, I got into UCLA. I did end up going there, but I got into UCLA. Well, so yes, I know how hard it is. I know how difficult it is to get into UCLA.
Big mistake on your part. Number two, good for you. It is ridiculous how hard it is to get in that school. Now
I know
back then it was a little easier because it just was before your time when he got in, but still I couldn't wrap my head around that. I didn't understand. I felt like something had to have been different. It's impossible, Martha.
No, you know what though? A part of me thought that, but Christian, and then I didn't, and I'm going to tell you why, because he talks about how he was, I think, again, you know, it's this addiction, this obsession. And he talks about that. He's very obsessive. And it all, I think to me, it all kind of plays into the character that he is, his personality, right? And so I did believe him when he said that even though all of this other craziness was going on, that he would, in fact, focus when it came to school. And he made sure to do his homework and he made sure to study. So I wasn't terribly surprised because I thought, you know what, that addictive, obsessive personality, it probably translated into him becoming obsessive about wanting to get good grades. And he talks about that. He says, it wasn't good enough for me to get B's. I needed to get all A's. And he would bring home report cards with A's. And I just could not. And then that made me think, you know, for all of this craziness, for all of this insanity, he is probably also a very bright person, you know? I mean, in spite of all of these decisions that he made and all of this, you know, his creativity and his smarts are there because you can't be having, you cannot have lived the life that he lived and scored all A's and then gone into UCLA.
It's impossible. That's why I feel like I'm blanching at it. Like this seems something is awry here. It seems impossible to me. So I will say though.
I believed it.
Once he's in UCLA, it's immediate total failure. He just feels so out of place. And
he does.
Because people there are serious and they study and that's what they do. And that's not his environment at all.
Yes. Yes.
I would like to point out that, you know, Martha and I, you and I are on the cusp of greatness. Okay. And so when we, I like how you're laughing hysterically. When our big first, you know, premiere party happens to launch our product line or our scent, whatever it is we sell out for, I want it to happen at Canvas.
Sandalwood. I'm a big fan of Sandalwood.
Fine. I like it too. I love that we get along about that. I want it to happen at Cantor's.
We're renting out the place. I mean,
no,
is that even? I want the whole place. Okay, I want fine. The entire place.
You're bigger you're a bigger diva. You need the whole orchestra.
I want the orchestra.
But again, Cantus makes another appearance in this. And I love these fixtures of L.A. Yes. You know what I enjoy reading about? These places, for better or worse, it is people, even though I can't stand the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know, these people like Anthony Kiedis and Duff and Slash, they were going to Cantor's back in the day before I think it was even Cantor's, in the sense that now it's you know, establishment in and of itself that's famous for being famous. The rainbow that we've read about repeatedly, that we read about in Anthony Kiedis' book, it was back then it was just a restaurant. Now it's not. Now it's a famous LA institution. And so.
Right. So is the Roxy and all those other places.
To read about these experiences that made these places those famous institutions is always interesting. And of course, we read that Anthony Kiedis is frequenting Cantor's and he's dashing and dining.
Yes.
And I did enjoy, there is a story he tells that he would dash and dine, and he didn't realize or didn't give any thought to the fact that that the waitress is probably having to compensate for the amount of money the restaurant lost. I don't know if that's true or not, but it occurred to him that that was a possibility. And he says that later in life, when he had money, he went back and he
makes it right.
Yeah. And Martha, I got to say, things like that to me specifically make a huge impact.
Me too, Christian. Tells me a lot about a person.
It does. I immediately thought of the Boy George story. That we read about, where he worked at the hat shop and he poured.
Oh, right.
And he hated the owner and he got fired because he's Boy George. He's a lot like Anthony Kiedis. He's just got a crazy life. He ruins the hat shop by pouring all this paint in the place.
Right.
And he watches the next morning. And he laughs hysterically to think of all the misery and headache he's caused for the hat shop owner. And we never, ever read, however, about Boy George making things right or trying to anyway. And that made a huge impression on me when I read it in the book, that he had a sense of the harm he'd caused. And I just wanted to bring that out because those things matter for me and they seem to matter for you too. There was something about this guy that I think this guy seemed to just have the most blessed luck in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about, he jumped off the pool and he survived, and then he gets in that car crash. And
right.
He even tells us that to this day he doesn't wear a seatbelt, which to me is outrageous considering what happened. And so I don't know. He goes to visit his mom, right? And we read that he decides he's drunk or high again, and he decides actually sarcastically to show his mom, "Look, I'm putting a seatbelt on." He only put the seatbelt on to make fun of people who wear seatbelts. And that's the only reason he's wearing a seatbelt, and he smashes his face and his whole body.
Right.
And he survives. And that happens to him over and over and over and over. Everybody around him is dying of ODs and drug problems. And he just seems, and a couple other times when the police pull him over, and he's got a whole bunch of heroin on his person.
Right.
And he's able to sweet talk his way out. But there's another instance where he's going into another country. I forget which one. And he's loaded up, I think, a portable like Walkman, a large one of some kind. And he's jammed a thing filled with drugs. Do you remember this? At customs, as he's entering a country. And he's pulled out of line because they take one look at him. And they.
Oh, right.
A red flag goes up. So they pull him in the room. And the guy immediately zeroes in on this apparatus, assuming that there's got to be drugs in there. And he holds it out to Kiedis and he says, "Make it play," because he can't get it to work because it's jammed full of drugs. And he's quick to, I guess he plays the CD, even though it's got a tape cassette player in it. So he just chooses to play the thing that works. And had he been arrested for that, who knows what would happen? And it happens a couple of times.
Right.
He's just able to walk this fine line. He's an inch away from total disaster and just skates on through. And it happens over and over. And so it's not just the drugs, but it's also surviving in the swimming pool, surviving in the car crash. And they're just, some people just have like lucky dust all over themselves. And he's one of those people. And considering the way he just seems to be wanting to destroy himself, it's frustrating. You know, it's just, there's no rhyme or reason. Some people seem to be indestructible.
You know what, though? I feel that this is something that we've also read in some of the other books where, you know, they're always just so close to getting caught, but they don't.
They don't.
And for similar reasons as him, right? Where it's, oh, you're so-and-so. Oh, never mind. Or they, something happens and they just escape, you know, getting caught just by an inch, right? And so I think that this is something that is also a common trait amongst all these people, that they just seem to, like you said, kind of have luck on their side. Because I imagine that if it was either one of us, it would never happen.
No. My luck is never run that way. I get caught instantly. It's all over my face.
It would never happen. It would never happen. They'd be like, oh, wait, this one. I don't know.
Yeah. It could be the reason we're reading about these people is because they did get lucky and make it through. The others died. That's so they didn't, they're not writing books, you know, but luck just seems to be on the side consistently and for not a good purpose. And so it's just sort of interesting to read. He himself seems to acknowledge it, you know?
He does. He does acknowledge it. He does.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, most of the book, Martha, is about women and drugs. I wanted to know your take on the women that populate this book.
What do you mean?
Because they do a variety of things. And his first girlfriend is apparently not faithful to Anthony Kiedis, okay? Despite the fact that he's slept with every female in all of the Valley while he's with her, he cannot tolerate that she's cheated on him. And he treats her like dirt. And he screams at her, yells at her, insults her, calls her a variety of names for having not been faithful to him. He can't conceive that somebody won't keep their word when it comes his way. He even says that similarly, Martha. I don't know if you picked up on this, but when they go to play one of their first gigs and he's not paid.
Oh, right.
Right. And he can't believe that somebody would steal, even though he's been stealing and breaking into houses left and right, taking anything he wants. There just doesn't seem to be a sense of a global sense of the world and his place in it. You know, it's just it's a double standard all the way through.
Right.
And he doesn't seem to acknowledge that either when he's talking about it. We've read about other people who kind of wink and say, you know, I do understand that this is somewhat hypocritical. There's not much of a tone in that. But anyway, so that girl cheats on him, God forbid, and she tries to get back together desperately, and so much so that she sleeps on his porch. Remember
yes,
that?
Yes.
And he won't let her into his house, and he makes her sleep outside. Well, I mean, she could leave, obviously, but she does it over and over and over and over.
Eventually, he does let her in, though.
He does let her in, but it's just so degrading and humiliating.
Right.
And I just feel like maybe it's the kind of female that he dates throughout the book that sort of has a chaotic thread throughout. But I just want to know what your take on all of the women that he dated.
The women that he dated? Well, yeah. I think that they were, you know, I think that they were like him. I think that they were troubled. And, you know, he even talks about at some points, he does mention the fact that he knew that he wasn't necessarily the best boyfriend. He does make mention of that because he was obviously unfaithful much of the time. He also acknowledges the fact that at least some of the women are a big portion of them, you know, they also had problems. They had substance abuse problems just the way he did. And so you can't expect that if a person has those problems, that they're necessarily going to be making the right decisions, not just in terms of what they're putting into their bodies, but also, you know, the people that they're dating and that they're together with. Right. And so I think that
attracts like, huh?
Yeah. I don't think I wasn't necessarily surprised by the type of women that he was with. I mean, I would have been surprised had the women been the polar opposite of that, because then I would have really questioned why were they with him, right? But they were just like him. So to me, it almost seemed like, yeah, that makes sense that they would be as intense. And I think that you know, that's one of the things that he also talks about. How a lot of the time with the women that he dated, the relationships were just so intense at every level, right? And so, and it makes sense to me. It's like these addictive personalities. And I think a lot of the time when people are, when they have that personality trait, you know, they like intensity and they like the fighting and the making up and the, you know, all of those things. And so I wasn't surprised at all. I expected the women to have been that way. I guess at this point, it shouldn't even surprise me, but I'm always surprised by the large number of women that these men are able to be with. I'm just always so...
Really? But they're yes. But they're famous. I mean, that's that.
I understand. I understand that. But it's still always so surprising to me. Different people have different standards. That's all.
So there's another woman who, and I guess this is what I was sort of getting at. There's just sort of a tenor or flavor to the women of the story. When they were recording Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic, okay, Rick Rubin decides that it should be recorded in a haunted mansion. I never get, that's always so pretentious to me. Can't you just, you know, why you've got to rent out an island, you got a haunted house. You know, we read the Trent Reznor rented out the Manson murder house. Why? I don't understand what that's all about. It's just so egotistical, but whatever, you know, artists are artists. And while they're recording that album, they've got a female, we don't learn her name, who services all of them in each evening. She has sex with every single member of the band as like a way to put them all to sleep at night. And that was a first. And yes. And he just had a way of describing these women as if these women are like are nurturers. You know what I mean? They're kind of earth mothers, and they're just givers, and there's a divine essence to them. They certainly were. We have read about such craziness, but there seemed to be an element of degradation to the way he went about thinking of all of these women. And, you know, we read that when he buys a house, he decides to decorate this fireplace so that it looks like a gigantic vagina. So each time you're throwing the logs into the fire, it looks like you're throwing logs into a large vagina. I mean, I'm thinking, who does that? That's 12-year-old. A 12-year-old doesn't even do that, but you know what I mean?
Right.
It's something that an adolescent who's just raunchy would do.
Well, I think that's the feeling that you get throughout the book itself is essentially a memoir of a drug and sex addict, right? I mean,
I guess so.
I don't know if he's a sex addict, but he's certainly, you know. He certainly engages in a lot of sexual activity with a variety of women. And it seems like he gets as much of a high from that as he does from the drugs, right? And so I don't think that I was necessarily surprised by all that. And I think it goes back to what we were saying before too, Christian. You know, like we never really get a feel for what he's like. But I think we were expecting more. But I think that ultimately the person that he presents in this book is essentially who he is, right? Because we never get much more than these details about his drug use, his sexual conquests. And there really doesn't seem to be a whole lot more, at least not that he shares in this book, right? So essentially, it really does become the memoir of an addict. Because there's not even a whole lot of music in this book. You know, one of the things that I also noticed was that unlike other books that we've read where, you know, they're the people that write them are super passionate about music and all of this. He doesn't necessarily seem to have or carry that passion. And it seems like it was something that he fell into. And to me, it appears as though his first love wasn't necessarily music, but rather drugs. And so this is more of an ode to that in terms of telling that story and his way out of it, because as he tells us at the end, he's been sober now and this book was written, you know, almost 20 years ago now. I think it was written in 2004. And he does tell us that he is now, you know, sober, at least at the point of that book. And I imagine that maybe he still is, I don't know. But it's not a memoir like the ones we've read. You know, there's a lot of, it is in the sense also, obviously, that there's all this, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But it just, the rock and roll part is what's missing, I felt.
Yeah, for sure.
From the book. But I think that that's just who he is. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like there's like a bit of arrested development, right? Where he went through all of this craziness as a kid, and it just sort of continued, and it sort of laid the groundwork for what the rest of his life was going to be like. And that's the impression that I got anyway, as I read the book. Like, there really wasn't a whole lot of difference from the time that he was a young kid.
Yeah, 12 to 32.
Yeah, there really wasn't that much of a difference. And I think in part it is because of his upbringing and the life that he was already leading as a child. I mean, he was essentially leading the life of a rock star before he became one. And so it never, the only difference was that when he became an actual rock star, he just now had the means to pursue the drugs and to buy the drugs on his own and not having to rely on other people to do that for him.
You know, as a dig to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, he tells a story, one of many, about scoring drugs. But it becomes more difficult when he becomes famous because people will or can recognize him. And he says he's at some trashy, horrible motel scoring drugs, or he's there to do them. And as he's pulling up, he doesn't really recognize because he sees a family that are all decked out in Red Hot Chili Pepper shirts, but they're at the same gross, seedy motel.
Right.
He talks about, you know, didn't want to disappoint his Red Hot Chili Pepper fans. And I was telling the location and the band, you know, you can make the connection about the quality of the music on your own, I guess. That's just my, you know, mean spiritedness there. You know, when we read Slash and other books, even though, you know, we joked around about how crazy those evenings were.
Right.
And I said, you know, they could probably charge money for, like, you know, follow over this routine for a night, see if you can handle it. Nothing about his drug use seemed remotely fun. He even himself seems curious about why he does it, because.
Yes, he does.
He just goes, he'll just get this overwhelming certainty that I'm going to go do this now. And he'll just get ready. He'll pack his bags, almost get prepared, go downtown. And then he'll just go into some gross hotel or motel. And, you know, it's interesting, no matter how fancy the place was that he went to do the thing, you got a sense management quickly figured out what was happening. And they'd stop sending up room service. They'd sort of just leave him to sink into his funk all alone. And he just does nothing, and his haze of nothing that goes on for days. And I love that equal to that, he's eating fast food, going on benders and binging. And in fact, he's always lying to his bandmates because he's so frequently falling off the wagon.
Right.
And he's convinced that Flea will figure out that he's back on drugs because there's an empty bag of Cheetos in his car. And he feels like that is a huge tell because he's so extreme in his behavior. He's either running around extolling the virtues of being healthy and not doing drugs at all, and he won't even tolerate drinking. He doesn't seem like a lot of fun. It's one or the other. Or he just goes on these hardcore benders. And when Flea gets into his car and there's an empty Cheetos bag, he feels like the cat's out of the bag. And I guess it probably is.
Right. And I think that that's also, you know, those extremes too, where he goes from being super healthy, and he talks about that, where he, you know, he won't even look at a bottle of alcohol. I mean, he really just, when he cleans up, he just, everything, right? It's exercise, it's eating healthy, it's all of these things. And so I think, you know, if we go back to the whole thing about the women too, I mean, I think that's just it for him. It's those extremes. And so I can't imagine him wanting to be with sort of a quote unquote normal woman, right?
Yeah,
someone who doesn't bring that sort of intensity of drama with them, because he needs that. It's almost like he feeds off of that, whether it's through the women that he's with or through the drugs, he's got to get it somewhere. So it seems as though, you know, there's always chaos, but you're right. I mean, when he talks about the benders that he goes on, it always just sounds so dark. I mean, I can't imagine that anything like that would be like a super pleasant experience, but you're right. I think when we've read about other people, I mean, you're thinking that it's all crazy and whatnot, but it's still kind of like, oh my God, like they were really partying it up.
Exactly the word, party. There was a party element to their drug use.
With him, it's essentially, he's doing this, like he's playing solo a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And he, And I feel maybe there's like some shame to that too, you know,
maybe.
But really there's just so much about that, that, I mean, I felt that, yes, he's the rock star, but the book itself wasn't.
Right. So there were two.
The rock star story, I didn't think. And, you know, for me, frankly, the parts about the book that were the most interesting was when he talked about other famous people and when he talked about other rock stars, you know, like those were the parts that kind of jumped at me because they were the ones that brought a little bit of, like a little bit of fun into the book, because everything else is pretty dark. And I think, too, you know, Christian, I've been thinking about this, too, after I stopped reading the book. Like, this to me has been one of the darker books we've read because there wasn't even a whole lot of humor in it. You know,
no, there wasn't. That's my point. There was no winking to the past.
No, there wasn't. Yeah. There was none of that. And it just read so heavy.
Truly. Yeah.
And, you know, when he talks about certain places that he goes to in downtown LA, I was thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, like he's really like bumming me out here. Like, I mean, this is just not. And it's 465 pages of essentially the same story being retold over and over again.
Yeah. I've seen a ton of these movies at this point, you know, the Cold Turkey stuff. None of it's that interesting anymore. But there were two details that, okay, well, that's gross and new. He says when he first begins doing heroin, he's mildly fastidious about it, but very quickly he's using toilet water.
Oh, God.
Do you remember that? He's using toilet water to cook up. And then he's using a syringe and the needle of the syringe is so, it's bent, but he's just adamant that, oh, I can still use this. Oh. And the needle breaks off into his arm.
Yes.
And he realizes, I thought exactly the same thing he did instantly. Like, ooh, you got a problem there, dude. Because if the needle travels down his vein, it can go into his heart and kill him. So he's pinching off this broken needle in his arm. Oh. And that's, you know, okay, you're being honest about the details. It's just all so gross. And so.
It is.
It's just bleak. And I guess that's accurate. You know, that's the story and that's how it should be. I don't know that there should be too much humor to the story.
Right.
Why would there be if you're doing these things?
Right.
But yeah, because there's so little music and it was just this. I will say I enjoyed the story of him sort of inadvertently writing their biggest hit of all time. It felt like he did actually write the song Under the Bridge and even the melody too. It sounds like that was pretty much just him.
Yes.
And through that story and that portion of the book, I really came to, I think we've mentioned that Flea does come across as seeming like an interesting person.
Yes.
He seems to be passionate about music. Whether or not I like it is irrelevant. He just seems to really be a passionate musician. He's tapped for a lot of other bands. And it seemed, I don't know, seems interesting. But John Frusciante does not seem fun. I did not care at all for what we read about him anyway. When he starts out being basically a hardcore Red Hot Chili Peppers fan, and because he's a talented guitar player, makes his way into the band. But some of the stories that we read about him from the very beginning and what they're doing with girls in motel bathrooms and how he's treating girls, he seemed like a mean guy. And then Kaitis does a really great job of describing what it's like to be on Saturday Night Live. And you know what I like, though? He's very upfront about the fact he's really not much of a singer. I did like reading that.
Yes.
And so it's because you know that he says he's terrified to sing Under the Bridge because he doesn't, you know, it's even hard for him to come in on the song correctly. He just doesn't seem to be musically inclined or oriented.
Right.
And Frusciante is just, he's just writing this art trip, artsy fartsy, artistic savant thing really hard. And the classic case of the artist who hates the success and thinks, well, this isn't what I wanted. And whatever we're doing, it can't be that good if it's this popular. So I need to make it interesting. So what John Frusciante does, and I went and watched the video. I do admit to that, Martha. Did you go watch it?
I did not.
So, yeah, Kaitis describes it as an absolute train wreck. And you can watch him, you know, get destroyed on live television because he's pleaded with John Frusciante, please just play it normal when you play it. Because you need to be able to drop into the swimming pool. Otherwise, it's going to be a big mess. And John Frusciante does not do that at all. I mean, you know, the opening of the song, I could even hum that opening guitar like to you. I'm sure you could too, right?
right.
No, he just destroys that thing of any semblance or recognizable notes. He turns it into this bluesy, bended note thing. And you really, because you, the reader, now know how Anthony Kiedis is feeling, because he's pleaded with the guy to please play it normal. And then to see the guy make it this avant-garde Cubist Picasso intro, you really, it's a very funny thing to watch. But I gotta say, you don't know? Yeah, I can't tell. You know, Anthony does a great job. As long as you don't tell people you're terrified and nervous, they don't know. And it works. But I really enjoyed that portion of him inadvertently writing this big hit. So often when we read these books, it's so predictable. I mean, like the, you know what I mean? Like, right. Oh, I remember what, and here we go. Here's 30 pages dedicated to In the Air Tonight.
Right,
how soon is now? Whatever. He didn't treat the song that way because music doesn't seem to be predominantly the theme of the book at all.
Right. He wasn't precious about it at
no,
all.
No, not at all. I'd say, so I like that. That was a novel. Like, oh, this guy really doesn't seem to care too much. And I thought that was refreshing.
He just cares about scoring.
Yeah.
Both drugs and women.
Yeah, those two things. And so when he's writing about music, it's kind of clinical. And so I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that a lot. I think we should tell everybody about the bug in the ear in the jungle. We have to.
Oh, my gosh, Christian.
Don't go to the jungle, people.
Don't go to the jungle. And every time, I mean, as I was reading that, I have to admit, Christian, I started trying to read it faster because I wanted to get through it because it was just absolutely, I couldn't. It was grossing me out. So tell the story.
Well, like a lot of artists who've coming off successful tours, I think Andy Summers did this as well. I think they almost got in some trouble or ran into some, I don't know, just gorillas with weapons. It was bad. Well, he decides to go to the jungles. I think it's Borneo.
Correct. It's Borneo. Right.
The trip is horrible. The guides get lost. They're lost instantly. He gets some horrible stomach virus because, duh. I mean, that's just par for the course.
What was he expecting, right?
Yeah. That's the souvenir you get in Borneo. You get a horrible stomach virus or malaria of some kind. He gets it. Quickly.
He gets dengue fever. That's exactly what he gets.
Right. And it's debilitating but he's still, because they're lost, he's having to hike 10 miles a day at a minimum while he's extruding fluids from every orifice known to man. And then that's just topped me off right there. You know, bad. That's not enough, though. He wakes up in the middle of the night with this horrible rushing sound.
Oh, my gosh, Christian, I can't.
He's, you know, freaking out. I think he would have freaked out more had he known. Or maybe he was just so incapacitated with his dengue fever that he just didn't care anymore. But the guy looks in his ear and he pulls from Anthony Kiedis' ear canal.
Oh, my God.
A large cockroach that had been crawling around inside of his head.
Oh, my God, I can't.
Yeah, I know. You get a sense he's just relieved that it's...
Out.
He doesn't tap into just how horrifically gross that is. He's just glad the pain's gone because he's in so much other pain.
And the whole reason for this trip, we should tell our listeners, is the fact that he is feeling very desolate and lonely. And so, you know what, let's just go to the jungle and get over these feelings.
Dude, that's a great idea.
I am always amazed at people, especially when they have large amounts of money, that they decide to go on these sort of, trips of, oh, I'm going to go find myself. I mean, with that much money, you can find yourself in a very nice, luxurious hotel or somewhere, have really nice room service and just be alone with your thoughts and do all your thing in the comfort of a 5-star hotel. I don't understand why, if you're already feeling terribly low and terrible, like, why would you want to add to that by going to somewhere in the wilderness? I don't understand.
but it is a universal human trait. Like I forget the name of the book, the one about the woman who goes on the hike across America. Reese Witherspoon played it. It was from a book.
Oh, yes.
I think a lot of people think, probably mistakenly, that a kind of an experience like that will just reorient themselves.
Not I. I will not do
if I want a stomach virus, I'll just order it from room service. I'll say, just bring it up here in air conditioning. Put it in something that tastes good at least.
My idea of becoming one with nature is in a nice hotel overlooking the ocean. You know, I mean, come on. Like, no wilderness. Your
idea is to go to the jungle cafe.
I can't even go to the jungle cafe anymore, Christian. I don't even think they exist. I think they're gone. They're all gone now.
The rainforests have been finally hacked to pieces. That's how you know they're really gone.
Oh my goodness.
So Strip's a disaster. They're so lost that he even gets a sense that the guides are thinking about cutting their losses and leaving him.
Yes. That's how lost they are, that they start fearing, both he and the other person that he's traveling with, that they start fearing that the guides themselves have no clue where they're at. I mean, that must be like the most awful feeling, Christian. You're in the middle of nowhere. You're relying on these people who are supposed to know the land and who are supposed to be your tour guides. And then you look over at them and they're just kind of like, oh yeah, we don't know where we're going either. I mean, can you imagine? Oh my God, I would have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't like it at all. I want to bring up something because I don't know, for whatever reason, I like to pick up the things that bother me. He decides he's on one of these trips. It could be the same one. I forget. And he decides he wants to go see the Dalai Lama.
Oh, correct.
And I did not come away thinking a whole lot more of the Dalai Lama. Not to say I did to begin with, but that tell me that colored your feeling for the Dalai Lama. Tell me, Martha.
No, you know, I have to admit that the one thing I did not like about that trip was that there were people, and I know this just from knowing about, you know, the Dalai Lama and people that go to see him, that there are people wait years to have an audience with him.
Does Anthony?
And that's, there is something about that that just rubbed me the wrong way, but not just, and it's not just him, but I think just well-known people, you know, like they get to cut in front of the line. And I don't know, there's something about that that just doesn't seem very, very fair to me.
To me, it's the Dalai Lama is like, yeah, you are more valuable. I cater to celebrity. He just seemed to participate in that world at large. And I just thought whatever you're teaching is worthless. If you hear Anthony Kiedis is there, you drop everything you're doing and you bring out your photographer to take pictures of the moment. I mean, what I enjoyed about that story was Anthony's telling of it, because even he told it in such a way to really let you know that he thought it was weird too. Like, all right, you know, he didn't ask to cut in line.
He did. He did. The way that he tells a story, it is in that way, you know, where he's a little perplexed by it as well.
Yeah.
And what he's further perplexed about is the fact that he then is allowed to go into a prayer service that they're having, where the monks that are there have to study for something like 30 some odd years before they are able to participate, but yet somehow he's given immediate access.
Yeah.
And there was something about that I also didn't like, but you know, I don't think that we should single out the Dalai Lama, because I think that this is something that everyone does, you know.
I'm singling out the Dalai Lama.
Well, I'm not, because it's not unique to him. You know, you
it's
see,
not, but he's the one that goes around pretending to be on some elevated plane. And
but
that's
they
why
all
these
do.
People work.
I think many, many religious people do. And so I'm not, I wasn't surprised by it, you know, because it's
so
again,
he's like the Joel Osteen then is what you're saying of that.
I'm not saying that he's the Joel Osteen necessarily, but what I'm saying is that a lot of people and a lot of it's everyone. It's not just religious people. It's everyone, you know, everyone who thinks that there is someone who has some celebrity or some name recognition attached to them. You know, they get to cut the line, right? They get to cut in front of the line and they get to get the photograph. And it's all part of the way the world operates. And so when I read that story, I was, you know, it just further validated the things that I felt that I feel about people in general of a certain name recognition and how they want to be attached to other people that also have name recognition. So I wasn't surprised.
I was totally turned off.
I'm already turned off by it. I'm already turned off by those kinds of actions. So it wasn't anything that further added to my feelings about all of that.
Another thing I did enjoy about the way in which he expressed something is he says that once the band has made it, he kind of feels at a loss about what to do with himself, because his prior getting there was sort of dependent upon him being outrageous all the time.
Right.
And he tells a story about before they'd made it, he and Flea. I mean, there must be thousands of these stories. I mean, he just tells one of the two of them getting on some light post and getting naked and doing, I don't know, something outrageous, something you and I and a billion people don't do. That's just a typical Friday for him. He just, all these, you know what I mean? All these things that they're doing to get attention. And now when he's famous, he doesn't need to do those things. And
because he gets it naturally because he's famous, right?
And I like that he feels like, okay, well, what do I do with myself now? I thought that there was something, that moment did have a sort of intellectual honesty about it that I thought was refreshing. And it's dovetailed with the story about really that is your identity. You're just sort of American Sex Pistols, and your skill and talent seems to be just shoving your finger at the man. Because when they're recording some video for one of their songs, when Dave Navarro's in the band, somebody gets it into their head so that they should kiss, and they just do it to be kind of, you know, outrageous. They don't really care one way or another. They just do it to be outrageous. They only find any value in his outrageousness when the execs see it and say, oh, no, you can't do that. You can't do it. And then he admits, oh, then we were all, you can almost feel his passion stoked again. Ah, this is what we need. Somebody telling us no. Right. Because this is who we are. Without that, they don't have an identity. There's just, they need a foil. They need a villain. And the villain happens to be the man. And I thought that was just funny. That's that he just so upfront about that.
Yeah. And I think that's where that brings them a different kind of high. Right.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It really gets them like, oh, okay, let's do something else. Let's see how much more we can do to really upset someone or to, you know. And for instance, he talks about that one instance where they go into a meeting and they strip naked before jumping on top of the table. And there's all these people from around the world from the record company. And they're just like, oh my God, ha ha. Wasn't that hysterical? And then they have a moment where he's like, it was funny, right? You know? And so that was funny to me. The fact that, you know, here they're like kind of like high fiving one another, but then they're thinking, oh wait, it was cool that we did that, wasn't it? As I thought, oh my gosh, they had a moment of reflection there. But yeah, there's always this outrageousness, which I think does bring them a different high. But you see, it's always extreme, Christian.
Yes.
It's always, everything has to be extreme. And so that's where they get their kicks from, right? Those extreme, whether they're being extreme, upsetting people or shocking or it has got to always be that. Anthony's book was just about drugs.
It was about drugs. Yeah. Sex. We were a drug memoir.
I'd be interested to see what other people who have read this book, if they read it similarly, you know, in terms of whether they considered it to be a true, rock star memoir, or if they considered it to be more of a story of drug addiction, because to me, it was so infused with that, you know, and there was so little music. I don't know. There was just so little music in this book compared to some of the other books we've read.
Well,
how are we summing up the book, Christian? How are we summing it up?
I don't have any thoughts to sum it up.
Two thumbs up or two thumbs down? Did you enjoy it? Would you recommend it?
It was B minus, you know.
B minus? Really?
Is it?
High. Yeah, I think so.
I don't think no one's proud of a B minus, are they?
I think it's not terrible. I mean, it's still a B.
All right.
I mean, I wouldn't be satisfied with a B minus, but
I know because you got into UCLA, like Anthony.
I did get into UCLA many years ago, many years ago. Yeah, a B minus is okay. It's almost average.
Yeah, it's just slightly better than average. You know.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. I'm just, yeah, it's just, what can I say? It's just, can't all be winners.
All right, well, Anthony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Us. Yes. All righty. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to our voyage as we continue. We'll be back again with another exciting jam-packed adventure. We're going to record the next one in a haunted house. Yeah, well, yeah, I'm doing it just to get in touch with, you know, artistic spirits. Yeah, like Anthony. We're going to do it, not just me.
No, I won't do haunted
That's
anything.
Right. You're going to be in your 4-star hotel. I'm going to go to Borneo.
You're going to go to Borneo.
Yeah, I'm going to get dang a fever and record
and
it from
a cockroach
my bed
in your ear, a giant
while
cockroach
I'm hallucinating.
In your ear.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Goodbye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay.
Take care. Just take a deep breath. It's okay.
I will.